Welcome to Engineering Innovations, the official podcast of Purdue University's Elmore Family School of Electrical and Computer Engineering. I'm your host, Kristen Malavenda. Imagine driving down the highway and your electric vehicle is charging while you're still on the move. No stops, no plugging in. Might sound like science fiction, but here at Purdue, researchers are making it a reality. Today, we're talking with Professor Dionysios Alaprontis, whose work on dynamic wireless power transfer and the future of the electric grid is helping pave the way for smarter, greener highways and a more resilient energy system. We'll dive into how this technology works, why heavy-duty trucks are the first focus, and what the grid of tomorrow could mean for the way we power our world. Dionysios, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So we'll start with the basics. Just tell me a little bit about your role here at Purdue and what your research focus is in electrical engineering.
Yeah, sure. My name again is Dionysios Alaprontis. I'm a professor of electrical and computer engineering. I've been here 12 years as a faculty member. I also did my PhD here a long time ago. So I am part of the Schweitzer Power and Energy Systems area in ECE. And as part of that area, our research is focused on electric power, meaning components like electric motors, generators, as well as power electronics and power systems.
So what initially drew you to this area to study power systems and wireless power transfer?
Yeah, great question. I'll have to go back in time a little bit for that.
Let's travel.
So let's see. Well, this may sound as a cliche, you know, but I became an electrical engineer because of my dad, who was an electrical and a mechanical engineer. At that time, they were doing those dual degrees. So being close to my dad and seeing what he was doing certainly had an influence, you know, at those years. I think at some point I knew I was going to go into some engineering discipline. I wasn't exactly sure that I would be doing electrical and computer engineering. What happened is in my home country, which is Greece, what you do is when you enter the college is you make a list of possibilities and you rank them. And so I could have become a mechanical engineer or a civil engineer. I ended up electrical and computer engineer because of my grades, you know, and how well I did in the entrance examination at that time. So why I chose electric power in general, that's another good question. At that time, you know, power was not a trendy topic.
Right.
Everybody was going into computers and communications. But I thought, you know, power is important. It really is what makes our society run. And I wanted to learn more about it because I understood it is such a fundamental thing to our society. So I was one of the few people back then that followed that track and took all these courses in power systems and electric motors and transformers. And in retrospect, this is probably one of the best decisions that I made in my life.
What, for your first areas of research, like what were you doing at the beginning?
Yeah. So at the beginning, even as an undergraduate student, you know, I was involved in research. And I was working at that time on wind turbines.
Okay.
So that was in the 90s. I was exploring a certain type of wind turbine and how to, you know, simulate it on the computer. And at that time, the tools that we had for simulating things on the computer were more rudimentary,
right,
more elementary than we have today. But that was a great experience, and that led me to come here. So the background I obtained from my undergraduate studies proved to be invaluable for my career here at Purdue as a PhD student and then as a faculty member.
How did you end up at Purdue?
Yeah, another great question. So another one of the influences in my life was my uncle. His name was Rocco Alaprontis, and he was a professor at Purdue.
Oh.
He was a distinguished professor of mathematics and economics. And I guess I realized, you know, hey, I have a family at Purdue. Why not come here? You know, I'll be close to my family. And, you know, also I didn't know that I was going to, you know, become a professor or a faculty member. So I think my uncle had had an influence on that. I saw what he was doing as a professor, and I think at the end I decided to follow that.
As opposed to going into industry.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one of your big things now is dynamic wireless power transfer. So you're testing that technology for electric trucks. Can you explain how that works kind of in terms that everyday people could understand?
Yeah, sure. So we've been involved, not just me, but with my colleagues, Steve Pekarek from ECE and Nadia Gritza from Civil Engineering and John Haddock, also from civil engineers. We have been thinking about this for the last several years, maybe five or more. So what is dynamic wireless power transfer? So it's a technology that is very similar to how we charge our cell phones wirelessly.
Okay.
When we touch them on the wireless thingy there and we get the juice. But this is meant for vehicles. So there's two types of WPT. There is stationary WPT, which is where you charge after you park on top of in your garage on top of a certain pad.
Right.
And your vehicle has one also underneath. And there is some distance, obviously, between them, but you can get the power like that. And the dynamic WPT is how you can do this while you're driving, while you're in motion. So there you have multiple of these transmitters, let's call them, on the ground. The scientific term is ground assemblies. And each vehicle has a vehicle assembly. And as it moves on top of these ground assemblies, it receives power on a continuous sort of manner. The physics behind that are not new. They're not like quantum sort of physics. They have been with us for more than 200 years. They're the physics of magnetic induction and magnetism and the magnetic fields. So basically the same physics that govern the operation of transformers, like the ones we use, you know, for electric power systems.
Right.
The difference being that this transformer is made out of air. There is literally no magnetic material.
Oh.
And so transferring power through the magnetic field at those relatively large distances is challenging. And what makes it more challenging is how to do it while you're moving.
Right.
While you're driving. And also the much higher power levels that are involved. We're talking about hundreds of kilowatts of power transfer for the heavy-duty vehicles that we are targeting, which is, you know, thousands of times, if not more, larger than the powers that the cell phones receive while they're touching the transmitter.
Yeah.
So that makes it quite challenging.
So do the vehicles, as they're driving, do they require a special sensor, or is it okay?
Yes. Yes. There are sensors on the roadway. There are sensors on the vehicles that will, activate the system. So the system is, imagine as all these transmitters, one after the other, on the ground. You cannot see them because they're buried several inches below the surface of the road. And so the system activates as you're driving. Think of it like a domino effect.
Gotcha.
Hit the first and it activates one after the other. So it's not active all the time and it's, radiating and causing harm.
Okay. And why did you decide to go with heavy-duty trucks first?
Because this is Purdue and we want to tackle the hardest problems head-on. There was many reasons for that. One main reason is that we are funded by the Indiana Department of Transportation, and INDOT has a big interest in traffic that goes through the highways in Indiana, and most of that traffic is freight.
Right.
As you know, if you drive out on the interstates, it's mostly trucks.
Absolutely.
And then there are other reasons as well. The main reason is that we have found, or one of the main reasons is that we have found that if you electrify the trucks, it will have a big impact on the total cost of ownership of these fleets.
Okay.
And so if you can reduce that, and we believe we can with this technology, then it will make transportation much cheaper.
Yeah, and these are the types of vehicles that are using the most gasoline and emitting the most things into the environment, correct?
Yes. Emissions is another big thing. And pollution next to the interstate. So these areas are very polluted right now next to our interstates. And solving this challenge, electrifying especially the heavy-duty trucks, would have a huge impact on emissions and air quality in those areas.
So you have a test bed right now outside of campus. Can you explain how that's working and what data you're getting from that and how you act on that?
Sure, yeah. So we have a test bed. It's a unique sort of system. It is 400 meters long.
Okay.
It's about 400 yards. It has 85 coils or 85 transmitters, one after the other.
Okay.
It's outside campus, I would say about 3 or 4 miles northwest of here.
Okay.
Between Lindbergh and Cumberland.
Okay.
If you're familiar with that area. And we constructed that system over the last year or so. The system is operational, meaning we can now transfer power dynamically to vehicles that are equipped with this technology. We have test vehicles that we have developed.
Okay.
Obviously, not your Tesla or your
right
normal EV. It is designed to power up to 200 kilowatts for each vehicle. Now, that power level is sufficient. It's designed for heavy-duty vehicles, of course. That's the power level that a heavy-duty truck, a Class 8 truck, as we say, that is loaded and is moving at highway speeds, you know, 65 miles an hour, more or less needs to keep moving.
Okay.
So the idea is that the power that we're transmitting to the vehicle is not really to charge its battery, but after it leaves the ground and hits the receiver on the vehicle and enters the vehicle's, let's say, power system, it goes straight to the wheels and it keeps it moving.
Oh, okay.
Of course, the vehicle management system can decide to use part of that power, if it so chooses,
right,
to charge the battery, to power other systems in the vehicle, like cooling and so on. But the level of power is decided based on the traction requirements.
Okay.
For the truck.
Okay.
So I said a lot, but did I answer your question?
Yeah. And are you looking at like data every day, every week?
Well, we're not testing. We're not out there testing every single day.
Yeah.
Currently, we are working very hard on preparing the test vehicle. Our final test will be done on a real Class 8 semi, an electric semi, a battery electric vehicle semi that will be provided by our partner Cummins.
Yep.
So this is a real vehicle, and we have been working hard over the last year or so to develop the components that will be integrated on the Cummins truck, and we're very close to that happening. Yesterday, I was down in Columbus, Indiana, in the Cummins facility overseeing some of that work. So we hope to be testing with the Cummins truck in the month of October.
Okay, that's exciting.
We have done preliminary testing with what we call our mobile testing apparatus, which is basically a trailer that we have equipped with a receiver.
Mm-hmm.
And we have tested that the system functions. So now we just want to test the system integrated on a real vehicle.
So when you get this system working, how does it look in the future? Like, will there be just certain sections of a highway that have these? And, you know, how often does a car need to go over or a truck need to go over it to keep going?
That's a great question.
Thank you.
I wish I could predict the future.
Yeah, right.
I don't know exactly how it will be, but yeah, you're right. This will have to be in sections on interstates.
Yeah.
And why interstates, you may ask me? Because most of the truck traffic travels on these interstates. And we believe that, freight and commercial freight will be the first adopters of this technology. We would have to electrify a certain percentage of our interstates. What that percentage ends up being, we don't know yet.
Depends on the testing.
Depends on, I would say not on the testing, but I would say depends on the economics, where it makes more sense to electrify. So, for example, we may decide, or the industry may decide, to start electrifying certain corridors.
Okay.
So freight, you know, has more or less predictable routes.
Yes.
It could be from a port to a certain location, or between cities and so on. So the industry could move towards electrifying certain corridors, major corridors with a lot of heavy traffic.
Yeah.
That would make sense. Gotcha. For this technology to be adopted.
Basically all of 65.
Yeah, I think we need, not all of it, but right. I think we need a significant percentage of the roadway.
Yeah.
So the idea behind the WPT is not to eliminate the battery altogether, but it's to reduce the battery, maybe by half or by more.
Okay.
And the idea is to have EVs that have enough battery to get you on that roadway, to move you, like you said, from part, you know, through parts of the roadway that may not have this system.
Right.
So we need certain capacity of battery to achieve that, and then out of the roadway to your final destination. So we may need batteries that you know, have a capacity to last for, let's say, 100 miles instead of 500 miles that we're trying to target today.
Makes sense.
And that will reduce the cost of EVs substantially.
Yeah.
And you know, it will reduce the total cost of transportation and make these systems, we think, feasible.
And so we're talking economic and environmental positive impacts.
There's many benefits. I could list, I need two pages to list you all the major benefits. You know, batteries are have materials that are hard to find, to extract. And so there's other geopolitical, let's say, benefits to reducing the need to have huge batteries on vehicles.
Yep.
There's benefits on our roads because the vehicles will become lighter.
Okay.
So our roads will not be stressed as much. There will be reduced wear and tear on the brakes, reduced, which when they wear out, they emit particulate matter.
Right.
There will be the same thing on the tires and many other things.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm forgetting right.
It's really exciting, though. It's an exciting project that I never thought about that, that at some point you'd be able to charge your vehicle as you're driving. It's
exciting. The more we, you know, when we first started the project, I was a skeptic like you.
Yeah.
But the more we work on it and we make it a reality, the more we think it can actually be a paradigm shift, that it's a realistic thing. It's not science fiction. And I would say that European countries are ahead of us in this. France, for example, and Sweden have plans to develop such systems at scale.
Okay.
So they have done the math and the analysis, and they have figured out that these systems make probably the most sense out of the other alternatives that we have.
Gotcha. So in addition to this electric vehicle work that you're doing, you're also part of the Grid of Tomorrow Consortium. Can you explain like what that is, what the mission is, and why is Purdue the one leading the initiative?
Yeah, yeah. So the Grid of Tomorrow Consortium is an initiative that is under our College of Engineering, under an umbrella called LEAPS. So LEAPS is large-scale, let's say, initiative from our college that has to do with the energy transition.
Okay.
And one of the components of the energy transition, like nuclear or other things, is the electric grid. And so we have started this consortium. The mission is to two things, basically, to lead research that could help, you know, advance the grid so that it can meet the new challenges that we have. And the second part of our mission is to bolster, you know, the workforce development in this general scientific area.
So like training students and engineers that have the skills to do that.
Because there's tremendous need for trained engineers that will help us solve all these challenges that we're facing as we're transitioning our energy systems.
What are the biggest demands on the energy systems right now? Maybe the biggest concerns and strains?
Well, The biggest in terms of strains or let's say megawatts or gigawatts mm-hmm. are the data centers that are coming online.
Okay.
So specifically data centers related to AI. So these data centers draw huge amounts of power.
Okay.
Like unbelievably high. For example, a data center could draw as much power as a power plant is producing.
Oh, wow.
So this, as you can imagine, this causes many, many different issues on the power grid.
Yeah.
Of course, EV is also becoming new loads. So you have electrification of transportation as a challenge. You have renewables that are, you know, uncertain and have a variability that you cannot control. You are integrating new storage, battery energy storage systems in the grid. But with all these things acting together and in harmony, like combining storage with renewables and mm-hmm. EVs and orchestrating these resources carefully,
yeah.
you can actually have a system that works better, that is provides electricity to customers more affordably and more reliably.
So when you mentioned that when you started off with the electric vehicle work you're doing that you were a skeptic. And I imagine that's part of what makes you a good researcher, because you have a lot of questions about things. So when you're working with PhD students or taking PhD students on, what qualities do you look for in them that you think will make them a good fit for your work?
Oh boy, I'm not a good recruiter, I can tell you this. But I think a good PhD student should have an open mind, should have a critical way of thinking and of questioning things. And of questioning the status quo, and of questioning what is written in papers. And I would like, the ideal PhD student is somebody who is given a problem and comes back in 1 or 2 months with some progress and some solution. But obviously in terms of skills, you know, we want students that are good with programming and hands-on experiences in building stuff, and obviously a lot of different things.
So a lot of what engineering is failures, right? And you learn from them. And sometimes that can be a real roadblock or devastation for students. How do you teach them to navigate around that?
Yeah, I mean, failures every day and challenges and roadblocks and things that go wrong. I think the best way to teach them is by becoming, you know, some kind of role model. Mm. How you, as a leader, let's say, of your research group, react to these situations. Keep your calm and try to find solutions and don't get disappointed and just keep pushing forward.
Perseverance,
yeah.
So you mentioned your dad and your uncle, and I'm sure that you had other mentors throughout your career. How do you view your role with your students or other professionals as like younger faculty members at being a mentor?
Yeah, mentoring is very important. Like you said, I've had several mentors in my career. I try to do the same for my students and other people, you know, from that I meet in conferences that are, you know, I'm connected with professionally. It's just an important part. Everybody should have mentors. I have my own mentors that I seek help whenever I'm frustrated. But it's important for everybody to mentor somebody else. Like if you're an undergraduate student or just starting college at Purdue, you could be the mentor to your younger cousin.
Right.
Or, you know.
Yeah.
Kids in high school.
Right.
So there's always this.
And from the mentee perspective, you have to be willing to accept the help and to ask for help when you need it, which some people sometimes struggle with.
Yeah. Mentors and mentees is a challenging relationship. I would say it's a lifelong thing.
Mm-hmm.
It needs respect. You need to earn your mentor's respect.
Mm-hmm.
And I think vice versa. And there's a lot of things that need to go right for a good mentoring relationship.
So you're in the lab, on the road, a lot of the time. When you're not doing that, when you're away from work, what do you like to do to maybe relax or just have fun?
Yeah. Well, I have a family.
Yep.
Which takes up most of my free time. I have two kids. Other than that, I like to read books. I like to read mostly biographies.
Oh, okay.
I find those fascinating. Fascinating.
About all different kinds of people, or specifically about like STEM people?
All kinds of people, like military people, mm-hmm. you know, politicians. They just open the windows and I can see writings, biographies, how people lived
yeah.
200 years ago, or, you know, through letters, you know, and you read in more detail
yeah.
the way of life. You learn how the way of life was back then, and you appreciate how we live today.
Absolutely.
How different it is. And I also like to play keyboard.
Oh, okay.
You know, a little bit.
Should have brought him today.
When I like to play my favorite 80s songs, but when nobody's around.
I got you. I got
in
you.
In my basement.
Do you see any engineering leanings in your kids? Like, do you think any of them are going to follow in your footsteps, either of them?
I think definitely my son.
Yeah.
All he likes to do is code.
Okay.
From the moment he wakes up, he goes to bed. So, yeah, maybe my daughter doesn't want to become an engineer because yeah. she sees how hard I work.
Yeah, it is a lot of hard work.
It is a lot of hard
work. But I think that one thing people don't really understand is you're having an impact on everyday people. You know, people, I think, have the stereotypical view of engineers in a lab, you know, just working away. But when you see the impact of your work, that's got to be gratifying.
Impact is a key word. It's what I think about every day. So impact can come in many forms. Most of the faculty think of impact as writing papers.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have impact by affecting other people's careers, by being the professor, you know, in a classroom
yeah.
setting, by opening up new windows to them. I've had people come to me in conferences that tell me, hey, you know, I took your class
oh.
you know, in 2009. And I became a power engineer.
That's nice.
That's because of you. And
yeah.
that's very nice. But you can also have impact by working on projects like ours, like large-scale testbed kind of problems. These are very challenging things to set up. And I'm very lucky to have great colleagues. We work together as a team because I couldn't have accomplished this testbed or managed it by myself.
Right.
We have great students, great colleagues. And these are hugely impactful things because they can affect not only research, but they affect things like standards, technical standards.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, we're working closely with the Society of Automotive Engineers, SAE,
mm-hmm.
to develop the new standard for dynamic wireless power transfer. We're
okay.
in that group. And the data that we will collect from the test bed will have an impact because it will be used to develop the standard. So yeah, impact is one of the main things that I question every day is what I'm doing impactful and in what way and how can I make it more impactful.
Great. That's great. This has been a very interesting conversation. Thanks so much for taking the time to share your insights today.
Thank you for having me.
That wraps up this episode of Engineering Innovations. If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. You can share it with your friends, your colleagues, or anyone curious about the future of energy and transportation. And if you really liked what you heard, we'd love it if you leave us a 5-star review. That'll help other listeners find the podcast, and it supports our work here at Purdue ECE. If you'd like more information about Purdue ECE, visit our website, purdue.edu/ECE. Follow us on social media. You can find the links to all our social media platforms in the show notes. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time for more stories about the engineers and innovations shaping our world.